welcome to our new monthly program on African authors, book publishing, and news on the continent, hosted by me, Laura Angela Bagnetto. Abuja-based Cassava Republic Press is opening a new office in the UK in April. We spoke to Emma Shercliffe, the director of the publishing house, about the news, as well as to find out what they have in store for readers for 2016.
The majority of our authors are Nigerian, but we have a number of authors from East Africa. You know, we're always looking for authors from wherever they may be in Africa.
What is your makeup of the offerings that you have?
So we do an adult fiction and nonfiction. And then we have a crime list, Cassava Crime. We have a romance imprint, which is one of the most successful parts of the business. It's got a lot of interest. That's called Ankara Press. And then we also have a children's list. And within the children's list, we have illustrated fiction, so from quite young readers. We also have a young adult list with some wonderful authors on that, including Nnedi Okorafor. Her book, What Sunny Saw in the Flames, is one of our most successful titles. We sold 24,000 copies of it last year. We've got a range of titles.
Can you give us an overview about the offerings of Cassava Republic going into 2016?
One of our big areas of focus for this year is the launch of our UK operations. So thus far, we're based in Abuja and we've published out of Africa. But we're taking some of our authors and some of our titles to the UK to launch the operation there in April. In February, tied to Valentine's Day, we are launching another two titles in our romance imprint. So far, we launched a digital romance list at the very end of 2014 with six titles. One's called Love Next Door and the other one called The Seeing Place. But we're also releasing print versions of the six titles that we published originally in digital. And they're really cute. They're sort of purse-sized books. We've had a lot of interest in those. We're really excited about the romance. And then we're really building up for launching the Cassava Republic list in the UK in April. We've got three new literary titles, L. Nathan John's Born on a Tuesday, and then a book called Like a Mule, Bringing Ice Cream to the Sun by Sarah Ledipa Manyika. The third literary title is Season of Crimson Blossoms by Abubakar Adam Ibrahim. So these are all authors who are very well known in Africa and in Nigeria, but we're taking them to the UK and really hoping to sort of establish them internationally. I should also probably just mention that we've got Cassava Crime. Our first title was Nkomo Wanyugi's Nairobi Heat, which we published a couple of years ago, which was very successful. And it's taken us a while to bring this list to fruition, but we've got another three titles on that crime list this year. The first is called Easy Motion Tourist by an author called Leye Edenle, set in Lagos. It's a gritty thriller, so an exciting one. And then we've got a female author from Liberia, Hawa Golokai, whose novel is called The Lazarus Effect. It's part of a series. She's got this investigative journalist called V. Johnson. This one's actually set in Cape Town, and it's fantastic. So we're publishing that in May. Later in the year, we've got an author we've already published, an author called Tony Khan. Nights of the Creaking Bed was one of his first titles he published with us. And his crime novel, also set in Lagos, is called Carnivorous City, and that will come out second half of 2016.
Going back to your news about launching Cassava Republic in the UK, is it because you're looking for an international audience for Nigerian authors, or was it because of constraints, publishing and printing? What was the reasoning behind the move?
It's a bit of both. Bibi Bakari Yusuf, who founded Cassava Republic here in Abuja, she's done a fantastic job at discovering authors like Teju Cole, Helen Habila, Lola Shanayan, and bringing those authors on. But the issue that we've always had is that we've really published just for Nigeria or for Africa, and we didn't really have the outlet to publish those authors overseas. The business model, I guess, now is sort of predicated on signing authors for world rights, that we can now publish not just in Nigeria or in Africa, but also in the UK. That's part of the model. And it's also just in terms of ease of distribution. I mean, ironically, it's going to be much easier for us to publish and distribute into East Africa and South Africa out of the UK. The intra-Africa distribution channels are pretty cumbersome for print, you know, issues with customs and tax and tariffs and barriers, and it's costly. So the model is really to become a global company and still have Africa very much as our base, but use the UK as an operating base to get to other markets.
You spoke briefly about e-books. Do you see that the more people are still more intent on buying actual books within Africa, or are ebooks catching on?
For us, I mean, one of the reasons we launched Ankara Press as a digital imprint to begin with was that we really wanted to test the market. So we thought if we launched with print and online at the same time, people would actually just buy the print. We launched, as I said, these six titles back in December 2014. We've sold at present just from our own website, ankarapress.com, and have had really a very good response. So we've made it as easy as possible. People can pay in pounds or in Naira or via PayPal, and you can then download those titles to any device. We know that people are buying online and buying ebooks, but you know, our experience here in Nigeria is that the tendency is still to buy on in print in the first instance. Although, you know, obviously things are changing quickly in other markets, and we see that here. And lots of people, of course, have smartphones and have the ability to download those titles. And part of the issue to date had been difficulties with payment, so with not having credit cards to pay for ebooks. But now that we can use PayPal, that's certainly made things easier. All of our titles going forward will be both in print and ebook format.
Are you looking forward to a new author coming out?
For me personally, the literary fiction, I think, is sort of the jewel in our crown. The three authors that I mentioned that we're launching in the UK this year, L. Nathan John, Sarah Ladipa Manyika, and Abubakar Adam Ibrahim, all of them are fairly well known already here in Africa. They're definitely authors that people won't have really have heard of. They're all very new and unique voices. And there's a big debate in the UK publishing industry at the moment about the lack of diversity, both within the publishing industry itself, but also just the lack of writers from different backgrounds that are published. So it still remains a very white and in some respects a very male-dominated publishing industry in the UK. We feel that we've got a real opportunity to introduce some new authors. So El Nathan's title, for example, tells the story of a young Al-Najri boy, a young boy he's not formally educated. His education is a religious Quranic education. And it's his coming of age story. It's set in the north of Nigeria. And it's told in this very sort of disarmingly simple way from the perspective of the young boy. But it addresses issues, religious fundamentalism, political extremism, that are obviously really at the cutting edge of contemporary debate here in Nigeria. So having these books of engendering debate is important for us. The book by Abubakar Adam Ibrahim, Season of Crimson Blossoms, which has already been published here in Nigeria, again is set in northern Nigeria. And that's quite different. It's about an illicit affair between a 25-year-old weed dealer, a street gang leader, and a 55-year-old widow. So this 30-year age gap and how they conduct this illicit affair in a very conservative northern Nigerian society. But again, it gives us this window into a society that's really not written about. I mean, even within Nigeria, both of those titles in particular have created quite a stir because there's just so little writing in English from the north of Nigeria. So I think those titles in particular, and then the novella by Sarah, which has a wonderful character. It's a 75-year-old woman. It's actually set in San Francisco, but the woman is Nigerian and is grown up in the north of Nigeria as well. And it's her story about aging, which is a topic really not discussed in African literature very much at all. So all three of those literary titles we think are bringing something very new and exciting.
Next up, we had a chance here in Paris to speak to an award-winning Ghanaian writer with a number of publications out this year.
I'd like to welcome to the program Nee Parks, who's a poet and a writer. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure.
Your first novel, called Tale of the Blue Bird, which was shortlisted for the 2010 Commonwealth Prize, has just been put out in translation in France under the title Notre Quelque Part, which you could roughly translate as Our Somewhere.
Yes.
And it won two awards here in France. Basically, language is so important to this book. It's a novel.
Yes.
But it's very key. How was dealing with the two Ghanaian languages that are in this book?
In the book.
In translation into French?
I think what was lucky in that sense, for French particularly, is that in Ghana, for instance, we share languages with La Côte d'Ivoire, which is a francophone country. So you do have that kind of shift between languages that we have, but also in French. And my translator was born and grew up in Benin. even though she doesn't speak Cri, she speaks Gengbe, and so there's a kind of similar structure to the language. So she was able to understand some of the games I was playing with language and some of the changes that happened. And the fact that changing language is an everyday thing for us in most of sub-Saharan Africa. When you're buying something, you're speaking one language, you're talking to your teacher, you're speaking another language, you're talking to one grandmother, you're speaking one language, another grandmother, you're speaking another language. And so I think she understood that, and that made it possible to get a great translation.
You give little snippets in two different languages besides English. Do you speak both of them fluently, or are these phrases that you know from growing up?
Well, my first language is actually Ga, and I wrote Tale of the Blue Bird in one of the voices, the hunter's voice, Opinipoku's voice. I wrote it thinking in Cri and transliterating into English. So the English structure in that is very odd. And the French translator, Sika Fakonbi, did a great job of doing something similar in French. I mean, I read the first chapter when she translated it, and I just said, no one else is going to translate this book. You're going to translate this book. And yes, language is vitally important to me. I was born in England when my parents were studying. So I went to Ghana at the age of 3 or 4. At the time, I spoke English and Ga. And then suddenly I was in this place. First of all, I was struck by how much light there was, because I thought the amount of light you got in England was as much light as you would get in life. But also, the first day in school, just the number of languages around me, and I would just listen. And I didn't understand it, but they all had a music. And for me, that's the thing I love about language, is the music. And so even the languages I don't understand in Ghana, I still like to learn phrases of, and in other countries as well. And I think that's what it is. So yes, I do speak Cri and I speak Ga. But also in there's Pidgin English, which is our own elevated version of English, which we use in Ghana. So all of that was very important to me, because I feel like there is no way of truly rendering an African city if you tell a story in just one language, because that's not what happens in those cities.
When I was reading this book, it's a crime thriller, I loved the attention to detail, to the tiniest details that could send somebody back to another place. And there was one piece that I really loved. Could you just read this for us?
Of course. Mr. Aqua walked to a small fridge in the left corner of his office, extracted a half-drunk bottle of Pepsi, took a swig, and replaced it. Mr. Aqua's thrift with the drink reminded Keo of the first time he had had Pepsi. He was 11 and had just managed to get a scholarship to go to Presbyterian Boys Secondary School. His father brought the bottle home, and they all had some. All of them. His mother, his father, his 4-year-old sister and 2-year-old brother, and himself. And his mother still managed to save some for the next day. Keo felt a familiar pang of longing as Mr. Aqua closed the fridge.
Everybody could identify with that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could talk about globalization, you could talk about the first time you did something, but I think everybody has a first time.
Yeah.
And
it's one of the things that's really changed over the generations, because I remember when I was a kid, when a bottle of Coke was opened, it wasn't for one person, ever. Even if you could afford it, it was something that was poured into a few glasses. And now a bottle of Pepsi or a can of Pepsi is opened and it's just one person and they might have a couple. And it wasn't an African thing per se. That's what it was like all over the world.
Exactly.
It was opened and shared.
Yes, and which is interesting, because if you look at the other parts of the book, when the forensic specialist, the main character, goes to the village, the same guy that who's thinking about this Pepsi here, the same thing happens to him as well. He's going back to before he went to the UK to study forensic science.
The book is very much about that cohabitation of things, that very often in dialogue we talk about things as though they're in opposition, but actually in much of life things coexist. You know, the past is walking along with us in the present. And in any country, if you go to the rural areas, you will find things happening that were happening 40 years ago in the city, but don't happen in the city anymore. And people in the city think the whole country is like the city, but it's not.
Can you just talk to us about how you created these characters? Because they're all quite different. They're not cardboard cutouts.
Yeah. One of the lucky things about growing up in Ghana is that secondary education, at least when I was in school, was subsidized, heavily subsidized, or in some cases free. I went to school on a part scholarship. But being in a boarding school, precisely because of the subsidies and the free education, you get people from all over who are from different villages, from completely different parts of the country, who have a completely different view on life when they come into school. And you sleep in a dormitory with 16 guys who, frankly, you would never have met otherwise. And for me, that has been a treasure trove in terms of building characters, because I know people who can go from angry to happy in 2 seconds. And I know people who it takes days to anger, you know, and I know people who will polish, you know, every little corner of their shoe. And I know people who just don't care. And I grew up with all of these guys, and they're all great. And that's wonderful. But also, we have this connection with our villages. We're still just a couple of generations from when everybody was in a village. Most of my father's classmates went straight from village to school. Every one of them, they can say, well, we're going for a weekend in the village, and they'll go with their friends, and you go there, and it's a different world. I mean, it's your world. You understand it. They're speaking the language that you speak. But the way in which they will kill animals to cook, or the way that they will share food, or everything changes. I mean, so for instance, the fact that there's no refrigeration changes the way in which people approach their food. So all of this is accessible. And luckily, I was able to access that. When I finished secondary school, I taught in a village of the north of Ghana. I taught biology and chemistry for almost a year. So there's all of those things come into play.
Let's move on to something that you have worked on. It's a collection of short stories called The City Will Love You.
Yes.
And these are stories, some of the stories have already been published
in magazines,
but not as a collection yet. I have two of them here, The Orange Story and When We Were We. Which is an interesting title, but it's also in everybody's conscience right now, especially because it's about migration.
Migration, yes.
And there are a number of characters in this short story and about what they had to do to get to the UK, where they are working and doing various things. I was wondering if you could pick a part that you really liked or that speaks to the heart of the story.
We are not the kind of Africans who cross the Sahara and traverse an ocean in some tricky vessel to get to Europe. We are too well educated for that. But we know several Sahara crossing Africans. One of our friends, Manu from Benin, came to the United Kingdom from Italy, complete with Sicilian gestures, fleeing, he claims, a family whose daughter he impregnated. He met her in a club where he worked the bar and did security on weekends. We met him at our local pub, the Duke of Wellington. Manu is in London with no problems because he has an Italian passport, but we still have problems. Kwame and I knew exactly where we wanted to go when we decided to leave Ghana. From what we had been told, what we had read in the brochures at the British Council, from what we could glean from films, London was occasionally rough, lock, stock, and two smoking barrels. But nevertheless, a place of unbelievable opportunity, my fair lady, Love Actually. We spoke the language, we worked hard, we had good degrees, so that's where we were going. When we were refused visas the first time and the British High Commission kept our money, we were bitter for weeks. Months, until our friend Hakim said, "Why are you worried? Just get new passports and apply again. Learn from your mistakes. A birth certificate costs nothing to get." He was right. Any details changed on a birth certificate make you a new person. Kwame had applied for a 1-year visa, although he only had an interview for a master's in psychology. Naive. I didn't have enough money in my account to prove that I could fend for myself over my proposed 6-week holiday. I calculated my cost based on naked. It was out of date. But after speaking to Hakim, we embarked on a revenge mission against the British High Commission. At the Market Research Center, Kwame is called Silas. At all my jobs, except lifting and shifting where Harry insists on calling me Dick, I'm called Richard. In Ghana, I was Sammy, Samuel Kwesi Asante. We are the kind of Africans who change our names. In the house we share in South London, all but one of four are name changes. Chinwe's name change has been the most eventful. He's a Yoruba living under an Igbo name. Wes, it is a name he considers a girl's name.
Thank you. I mean, there's so much just in what you read.
I was hoping to, yeah.
Do you know people who have done this?
Yes. I mean, every time I fly, I speak to people on the plane and I'm stunned by the stories of how people got to where they are. And it's astounding, the range of stories. And actually, the one thing that's become very clear in speaking to people, because sometimes I'm flying home and I talk to someone who hasn't been home for 15 years or 16 years, 24 years, and I say, why? And they say, we were waiting for papers. So they were waiting to legalize their status before they could go home. And then I asked them, so what if you didn't have to do that? And actually, 70% of them think they would have returned home by now. So it's a real irony that actually the criminalization of under the table migration or under the cover migration is actually keeping migrants in the West, because for many of them, they actually only want to get some money to start something at home. And they're never satisfied until they can show at home that they've made something of themselves because of the risk they take to leave home. It's a strange situation. But again, you know, this is one of the beauties of fiction, that you can explore these ideas and bring it to the consciousness of the reading public, the general public sometimes. And hopefully something happens out of it. But even if it doesn't, at least it becomes a talking point.
Oh, well, definitely. Because I bet a lot of people didn't realize that that's exactly what keeps people in one place who come from continent of Africa.
And it's not just that. I mean, when you think about it, you know, before the era of borders and passports, that's what people did. They migrated, they made their fortune, they went back, and stories were written about them, or sometimes they went back to become a mayor, you know, something. All these stories, that's what they are. You know, you had Russians who ended up in France and French people who ended up in England. And when I studied briefly in France, the number of my classmates who were of Italian origin and Portuguese origin, Spanish origin, whose fathers had come just to work for a season and picking strawberries or something like that and just ended up settling, it's extraordinary. And then sometimes the grandchildren would be talking about going back to the home country. Migration is the story of humanity. Unfortunately, we've put these borders in between and made things so complicated that people are dying unnecessarily.
Would you give this to somebody who makes decisions on migration? I mean,
you know, one of the things about being a writer or an artist, you get invited to these public functions where you're sitting next to a minister or something like that. So it's not that I don't keep it secret. I make it very clear what my position is. I'm lucky. I mean, my family is a prime example of how random this is. My parents were studying in England when my older brother and I were born. And my younger sister and my younger brother were born in Ghana. So when they're coming to Europe, it's a whole palaver, all sorts of hoops that they have to jump through. But we're from exactly the same family. We all like being at home. We don't like being anywhere else. I mean, if we're going somewhere, we're going on holiday. but they have so much trouble. And it's really about serendipity, the fact that my parents were in England when we were born. So we're dual nationals. I have a Ghanaian passport and a British passport, which means that I can move very easily in Europe and very easily in Africa. And they just have the one passport. So every time they leave in Africa, it becomes a big deal. That is basically what our policies create.
This story is part of this collection.
The City Will Love You.
Is this your first collection of short stories?
This is going to be my first collection of short stories. I've been writing short stories for a while, partly just to take a break from writing novels and poetry. But the idea of writing this collection came when I was living in a really tiny studio in London. And I realized my own habits were changing because of the space I was in. The thought extended to then the city and to look at how people's behavior and lives change when they live in cities. And so a collection of stories started to come together. There were already three stories and I started to build around it. And I've tried to kind of move them around a bit. So there's one story that's set in Toulouse. There's, you know, there's a story in London, of course. There's one in East Africa, in Uganda. There's a couple in Accra. But they're all really different. And they're both showing what we do to survive in cities, but also showing the diversity of cities around the world, that you find all these people from different places in these cities. And it was a great, exciting project to work on. I'm looking forward to it coming out, and it will hopefully be a bridge between this novel, which is already out and has been out for a while, and the next novel Asuka, which is a very weird novel about a non-existent Spanish-speaking Caribbean island.
Azúcar is sugar in
Spanish.
In Spanish, so do you speak Spanish as well?
No, I took some classes as I was writing the novel, which is why it's taking a while. So I have your very basic hello, goodbyes. But I've got enough to work the novel and get it to the end.
And so what's inspired you? Because this is totally different from what you've just presented.
Yeah, I mean, the novels are all sort of about ideas. And I like using non-existent places because nobody can argue about the position of a street lamp when what I want them to do is think about humanity. This is a particular problem for African authors because our work is read as travel guides very often. I mean, the number of people who've said to me, I bought your book because I was going on holiday to Ghana, you know, it's astounding. And then I always have to tell them that village does not exist. I hope you didn't go looking for it, you know. So it's a particular problem. And I do want to talk about ideas. So the first book, Tale of the Bluebird, is very much about power. But of course, you're also a storyteller. You want to entertain. So I focus on telling a story, making it entertaining. And all those things are in the background. And they're the engine of the story, but not the main story. And with Azúcar, I am looking at belonging, the idea of how you come to belong to a place. So there are two main characters in that story, one whose parents are from the island but was born elsewhere, and one who migrates to the island but comes to feel like they belong there. And so there's a love story. And then the sugar part is, I always like a touch of the outrageous. So the person who's born outside the country but whose parents come from the island inherits some land on the island, but the land is saturated with sugar, so nothing can grow. That has to be resolved. And that I was playing with that as a metaphor for places that have lots of riches, but the people don't benefit from.
And as, again, your love of language is even going forward in this as well.
Yeah. No, I mean, any opportunity to learn a new word in a language is always a joy for me, because there's lots of jokes that happen once you start to play with what something means in one language and what it can mean in another language. And there's, endless hours of fun to be had.
How did you become inspired by this? Where did you go to the Dominican Republic, perhaps? Or
no. I've always loved Spanish as a language. And I think that's partly because when I was growing up, I used to read lots of pulp fiction from the US, from the UK. And a lot of the time, the foreign words that were in those things tended to be Spanish words, you know. So there'd be some kind of Latino lover boy or criminal or something, and they'd drop the odd word here and there. There was that kind of attachment. And then in my early working life and when I was in university, I had some Spanish friends, and so there's all of that. I also visited Cuba, and I love Omar Portuondo's music. She's the female element of the Buena Vista Social Club. So there are lots of little triggers. I chose the Caribbean and chose not to make it English because I thought English would be too predictable. So I chose to make it Spanish, but it's about the Caribbean. So it's both about the love of Spanish and the Caribbean, the fact that our histories are so tied in sub-Saharan Africa to the Caribbean, and that it's not explored enough. And so the character that migrates is from Ghana, of course. But again, he's in a country where, fine, he may have gone there not speaking the language, but he doesn't look like he's not from there. It's not overt in the writing, but it's there. The fact that you can walk into a place or land in a place in the Caribbean and no one will actually question you until you start speaking, because of the slave trade and related issues, that, you're at home in this body of water with lovely beaches and nobody will question you.
Is there someone that you look up to or a certain writer that you would say, I'm inspired by this person?
I tend to read in volumes, and I don't particularly mark a direct inspiration, but there are always writers whose work kind of haunts me. One of them is Mariama Ba, who's a Senegalese writer who wrote a book called So Long a Letter, Une Si Longue Lettre in French, which was translated into English, that I read first in school and stayed with me. There's Miyakuto from Mozambique, who I think is one of the most outstanding living African writers. There's Atukwe Okai, who's my mentor from Ghana, who's a poet. And his work was really instrumental when I was a kid in, I suppose, making me aware of the joy of playing with language, because there's lots of linguistic play musically in his work. Those are the seeds, perhaps, within the continent of the writers that I would say have been very inspirational. Of course, Ngugi wa Thiong'o's Decolonizing the Mind, which is, you know, nonfiction, was also really important in my understanding the importance of holding on to and owning who I am. There was this huge debate some years ago between Ngugi's position of writing in your local language and Chinua Achebe, who was saying write in English. I don't agree with either of them. I think we're hybrids. And so that is what I try to do in my work, is to express that beautiful hybridity that we have, the fact that we can move from what we call in Ghana the Queen's English, all the way down to the basest of whatever region you want in Ghana, the local language. I think that's beautiful. There are few people in the world who can do that. And it's one of the remarkable things about sub-Saharan Africans, particularly Ghanaians that I know in England, that they'll be working in one of the biggest law firms, and then at the weekend they'll be in a chop bar somewhere, just getting to grips with some fufu.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
As a writer, it's always the greatest joy to talk about ideas and talk about the kinds of things that you're into at the moment. Yeah, it's been wonderful.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. Nee Parks, who's going to come out with Azuka, your second and latest novel, as well as your collection of short stories.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have on our program today. If you've enjoyed these interviews, check out our page on rfienglish.com's website for the longer version. Thanks for listening to Africa, Stories in the 54. I'm Laura Angela Bagnetto.